This is Audible.
Trapeze Presents, Witness X. Written by Essie Moorhead. Read by Madeline Brolly. There are things known and there are things unknown, and in between are the doors of perception. Aldous Huxley. Prologue. I used to think of sleep as though it was swimming in a pool. Some nights I slept deeper than others. Now, after seeing you beneath the water, eyes open but blind, I wonder if death is the same, different layers, different depths. I can't change the past. I can only reach out so you know how much I miss you whilst we are absent. One from another. Chapter 1. Thursday, 1st of February, 2035. 5:45 p.m. The low, booming growl of mortar fire filled Kira's head, quickly followed by the rapid crack of gunshots. She was still sightless, but all around her she could hear bawled orders and yelps of pain. Over everything was a blanket of suffocating heat. She jolted backwards as the visual burst into life, and she saw figures in desert camouflage uniform carrying weapons as they ran for cover, like a horrifying clip from a war movie. In front of her eyes, no, she had to remind herself it wasn't her eyes, but his eyes, a crumbling wall exploded into rubble. Everything became a blur of yellows, brown and khakis beneath sunlight so harsh it hurt to look. Was this Afghanistan? Basra? Helmand, maybe? It took her back to when she was a child, playing with Emma on the carpet while her dad watched the news on the screen. The scene suddenly switched, the desert sun setting low, a melting golden ball sinking into the horizon, the sky daubed with dazzling orange and lilac. Kira dropped her gaze to see desert fatigues, well-worn army boots and a rifle clutched in her hands. Some instinct told her it was a 59 Mini-Me, even though she'd never held a gun in her life. She inspected the smattering of fair hairs catching the light, the muscles that tensed beneath the freckled skin. These weren't her hands, her arms. They were brown rigs. Night fell, hot, dusty, black. Not city black, like she was used to, where the light pollution sent out a constant glow. This darkness was an inky cloud, smothering her. Pitch pouring into her eyes, her ears, her mouth, so that it was difficult to breathe. Had she lost transference? But her eyes slowly adjusted and she gazed around. Up ahead, she saw the tiny glimmering lights of oil lamps in the small square cut-out windows of mud-built flat-roofed houses. Clusters of shrubs and grasses rose behind them and beyond those, sand and rock that she imagined stretched as far as the horizon. She made a few more observations through Brownrigg's eyes, registering and logging details, as his body swiveled round until her gaze came to rest on two soldiers, one male, one female. Brownrigg held his fist up and they stopped still. There was no sound. Kira tapped her VR headset. Then there was a crackling in her ear and a voice came over a radio. Execute. Brownrigg jabbed a single finger and led the others towards the houses. She could feel the grit of tiny stones beneath his boots as he crept forwards. There were three wooden doors in the small complex. Kira watched as he directed the two soldiers to the outer ones, and he stood in front of the central one. A three-finger countdown, and they disappeared into the buildings. Brownrigg entered blind, his gun pointing ahead. She could feel his heart rate rising. There was no night vision device, the only light a small torch attached to the barrel of the gun, casting a tiny beam of brightness around as he searched the property. Clear, came the male soldier's voice. Clear, echoed the woman. A movement ahead caused Kira to catch her breath. Brownrigg crept closer to examine a bundle of rags on the ground. She could feel the tension in his shoulders as he held his rifle close to his chest. The scraps of cloth at his feet appeared to squirm. She felt his body as he stepped back into stance, his finger twitching at the trigger. A small, fragile hand appeared slowly from beneath the rags, then the fevered face of a young boy. Brownrigg immediately relaxed his body and blew out a lungful of air. He swung his rifle round on its strap so that it rested against his shoulder blades and knelt down.
You okay, mate? Feeling poorly?
The boy looked blankly at him. Brownrigg reached out to feel his forehead. The child moaned and tried to move away.
Don't worry, mate. We'll get you some help.
He sat back on his haunches and went to reach for his radio. As he did so, the boy's other hand shot out from beneath the material. He was holding a curved, rusted blade. He lashed out awkwardly at Brownrigg, but it was enough to do damage. A poker-hot sensation traced a jagged line across Kira's throat, followed by a burst of adrenaline and panic coursing through her body, through Brownrigg's body, as he jerked backwards. The child jumped up, shedding the tattered cloth, face jubilant. Outside the house, a man shouted unrecognizable words, and the boy stood up straight, alert. The crack of a rifle cut the voice dead. The child hesitated, blade still in his hand, then spat viciously in Brownrigg's face as he lay grappling at his throat, the blood seeping wet and hot through his fingers. Then the boy ran out of the door. Brownrigg flailed and writhed on the ground in blind panic. He kicked out, knocking a small table that clattered to the ground, the sound of glass breaking. Kira gulped in air, feeling his primal fear. She heard his colleagues shout to one another. A single gunshot. Then the silence of the desert. Finally, what seemed like minutes later, the two soldiers appeared and leaned over him.
We've got both of them, sir, one of them said. Hold on. Stay with me now.
His companion shouted coordinates into the radio, begging for urgent medical help. Then everything seemed to melt into the blackness. Kira leaped up from the recliner she was lying on and ripped off her headset, but her eyes were still blind in the blacked-out lab. She moved around frantically until someone grabbed her tightly by the arms.
Get off me!
She yelled and started kicking out. There was a man's cry of pain, followed by a voice, loud in the darkness.
Cosmo, lights 50%.
Immediately the room brightened. Disoriented for a moment, Kira stood still. Her lab partner was holding her steady.
You're fine, Kira. You're in the lab. It's me, Jimmy.
She looked around, saw the familiar machinery, the black granite worktops, her mug sitting nearby, and began to settle. This wasn't the first memory transference procedure they had done, but she didn't usually react like this.
God, Jim, I'm sorry.
You've done worse.
He smiled, then let go of her, arms still outstretched for a moment, before he bent to rub his shin.
Oh, I was scared.
I know.
He guided her back to the recliner with a gentle hand on her shoulder as she struggled to get her breath back into a calm rhythm.
Just take it easy, he soothed. It's okay, Kira. You're okay.
She sat down and swiped at her throat, feeling sweat and mistaking it for blood. She held trembling hands up in front of her face. Her own hands. She turned them over slowly. Clean. Her heart rate began to slow, but her breathing was still strained. She tapped her fingers against her chest. Jimmy understood instantly and pulled his inhaler from the pocket of his white lab coat. Grabbing it from him, she pumped the canister and sucked at it desperately. Moments later, Kira could feel her airways starting to open up. Her breathing became steadier, deeper. The sweat began to cool on her body, and she reached up to feel her neck again. Jimmy watched her, concerned and confused. He patted her back briefly.
Not going to puke this time.
She shook her head grimly.
Made sure I didn't eat beforehand.
You're getting good at this, he smiled. Try to get some water down.
He reached for a glass on the nearby work surface and passed it to her. She drank thirstily, grateful to have him nearby. Jimmy checked her pulse with an electrical monitor and examined her eyes with a transilluminator. Kira glared angrily towards Carter, her business partner and owner of the Carter Tech Lab.
Look forward, commanded Jimmy. Pupil reaction normal, he said, and took the empty glass from her, replacing it on the worktop.
The army, Carter! The bloody MOD, after what we'd talked about, she said angrily.
Carter put one finger to his lips and with his other hand pointed to Cassandra, the large white donut-shaped machine on the other side of the lab. The bright white metal of the apparatus contrasted with the dark grey walls and black work surfaces. Lying on a white bed with his head at the centre of the aperture was Lieutenant General Brownrigg from the MOD.
Carter shrugged. Business is business.
I'm bringing him out now, said Jimmy.
Kira lay back for a moment. Even the ceiling was dark in the lab, painted black to hide the wires and the air vents. She supposed Carter thought it was stylish. She gave Jimmy a weary thumbs up.
Cassandra, retract bed, Jimmy said as he carried a glass of water over.
There was a gentle whooshing sound as the bed moved forward, bringing Brownrigg out of the machine. He sat up slowly and took the glass. He seemed much older than a usual serving soldier, and Kira concluded that the memory of his that she had seen had been from early in his career. He didn't speak at first, but watched her with his steady, fixed stare as he drank his water.
Do you feel all right? Asked Jimmy.
Brownrigg nodded, finished his water, and handed his glass back to Jimmy, who said, The pico-stimulators and nanoreceptors will pass out of your bloodstream in the next few hours. You won't feel a thing, but it's just as well to drink plenty of fluid.
They're the things that I couldn't see, that you injected me with, Brownrigg said.
He must have seen Jimmy's face fall, and said with a wry smile,
Don't worry, son. I've been injected with all sorts in my career. Didn't know what most of it was.
His voice was deep and smooth. He was in good shape for an older man. No paunch, his shoulder and chest muscles visible beneath his crisp, pale blue shirt. He swung his legs neatly round to the side of the bed, but Jimmy raised a hand.
Give it a minute or two so I can check you over.
Carter leaned against the grey wall, half hidden in the shadows. He wore a midnight blue pinstripe suit with a handkerchief that matched his pale aqua tie. All tailor-made, not available in the shops. Many of the Chinese businessmen wore them as a symbol of the rapid rise in wealth of their country over the last decade, and suits were beginning to make a comeback in London. It was another of Carter's pretensions, Kira reflected, like the white coats he insisted she and Jimmy wore, as it made them look like professional medics. Even though they were technically equal partners in the company, his suit made the statement that he was clearly the boss, never mind the fact that his name was above the door. Interestingly, Carter never let her delve into his memories. Too intimate, he said. Something to hide, she wondered. Carter had been nervous before the transference, and, if she was honest, so had she been. He had been cagey about the client, but Carter had reassured her that afterwards they would make a decision together about how to proceed. Sometimes she was grateful to him for offering her the opportunity to develop her technology. Other times, she wished she'd picked her money more carefully. All those promises about the tech going to the right people, he hadn't meant any of it. He was headstrong, but then again, so was she.
So then? Carter said expectantly, nodding at Kira.
Brownrigg locked eyes with her, and she felt a connection with him. How could she not, after having been in his memories?
There was fighting, soldiers. The desert, maybe Afghanistan, she said.
There were three little houses. I thought they were abandoned. But then there was a boy, just a child.
Brownrigg watched her, unperturbed.
What had happened out there? Had it affected him at all?
It was a... She searched for the word. An ambush. The boy cut you.
She reached up to her neck again. He slashed your throat.
No reaction.
She said the next words very quietly. Your colleagues shot him. How could an experience so awful, the killing of a young boy, whatever the circumstance, not show in his expression like a veil of grief and regret? Carter's eyes flicked between the two of them. Brownrigg reached to open his shirt collar and reveal a long, red, ragged scar.
"An accurate account, Dr. Sullivan," he said, his voice steady.
Carter's face lit up. Relief, she assumed. Kira rubbed her brow, still feeling disoriented. Her eyes wandered onto the black granite worktop. She studied the tiny, glinting silver flecks in the darkness to ground herself, wanting something solid, familiar. Her eyes moved along to her mug. "Hand over the coffee and no one gets hurt," a present from Jimmy. Then she looked up to one of the glass walls of the lab, her own reflection visible against the dark backdrop of the corridor beyond. She saw herself clearly, her short, choppy, dark bob, her long legs bent up in front of her, her shoulders that were a little too wide. She locked eyes with Brownrigg again, feeling a guilt that didn't belong to her.
Did he die? The boy? She asked, afraid of the answer.
Brownrigg didn't reply. Instead, he broke her gaze and stood up. Carter jumped in.
"As you can see, Lieutenant General," he said, "Dr. Sullivan has developed quite extraordinary technology in Cassandra."
His face was earnest, trying too hard.
God, she resented him.
Brownrigg smoothed his clothes. There was something almost coy about him now. She wondered if he felt vulnerable after the transference, a scientific version of the morning after walk of shame.
"You most certainly have," he said to Kira, still not looking at her. "Cassandra, like the Greek oracle."
He smiled, but she wasn't sure if his tone was mocking.
"Remind me, what does Cassandra stand for again?" he asked.
"Computer-assisted scientific neurological detail recall aid."
"So, now you've sampled the goods, so to speak," Carter interrupted, ushering Brownrigg towards the door. "Let's talk terms."
"I'm fine, thanks for asking," Kira said.
Carter scowled but kept moving.
He wasn't even going to include her in this part of the process. Irritation bloomed in her chest, and she stirred unsteadily, moved over to them and grabbed at Brownrigg's shirt sleeve. "May I ask?"
The two men paused and faced her.
"How will you use my technology?"
The muscle in Brownrigg's arm was rock solid under her fingers. He glanced down and she released her grip. Carter glared at her. Brownrigg, however, appeared unperturbed and gave a thin smile.
"Tackling terrorism."
"How?"
She wasn't going to let this drop. He hesitated, then continued in a firm voice.
"Interrogation. We believe it could be useful in getting information about terrorist cell members even after an attack."
He waved a hand through the air.
"Their contacts and addresses, locating where the cells meet or where the weapons are coming in, that sort of thing. If we can catch a live one, then there's no reason we can't get some intel that would prevent an atrocity."
"Interesting." She cocked her head to one side, pretending to consider. "But I think the human rights lobby will have something to say about invading people's brains against their will."
Carter's face darkened.
Brownrigg smiled, clearly amused by the sudden tension in the room. He took a few steps towards her.
"Dr. Sullivan, terrorism will only get worse as the gap between the rich and the poor continues to polarise. I am sure the British public will be eternally grateful for your technology and the lives it can save."
They stood for a moment, eyes locked. A defiance rose in Kira.
"I'm disappointed, that's all."
Her heart was thumping as Carter glared at her.
"But no matter. At least the criminal justice system will get full permission from their clients when they use it."
Brownrigg looked at Carter, confused.
"This isn't what we'd agreed."
Kira saw something pass between the two men.
No, this is merely a misunderstanding, a lack of communication, that's all," Carter stammered.
This has to remain classified, Brownrigg said firmly, his expression serious. He pointed at Kira and Jimmy. You do understand the implications if this sort of technology gets into the wrong hands. Do you realise just how powerful what you've invented is? Kira didn't know whether to be flattered or outraged. Who was he to tell her what she could and couldn't do with her own invention? Imagine how this could be used against us if... Brownrigg began.
Her us? Snorted Kira.
Carter scowled at her. Dr. Sullivan, Brownrigg said in a low, menacing voice, your technology is going to save people's lives, and in order to do that, it must be kept top secret.
Top secret? Kira guffawed.
She looked over at Jimmy, but his face was white. It hit then that Brownrigg was deadly serious. What I am trying to express to you, Dr. Sullivan, in no uncertain terms, is that this technology would be dangerous in the wrong people's hands. It needs to be kept confidential. We can't take the risk.
I invented this technology. She was openly angry now. It's not for you to decide.
You'll be compensated, he said coldly.
I don't want to be compensated. I want this tech to go to people who need it. The criminal justice system.
Sort this, Brownrigg commanded Carter, making a waving movement with his hand.
Oh, of course, it will be sorted, Carter said obsequiously. Let me show you to my office and we can talk privately.
Brownrigg moved through the doorway and Carter jabbed a finger at Kira angrily. Nausea suddenly overwhelmed her and she sat back down on the recliner, exhausted and disappointed. This wasn't what she had had in mind. Not at all. Chapter 2. Thursday, 1st of February, 2035. 6:02 p.m.
I'm absolutely fine, Kira insisted as Jimmy's fingers flitted over the virtual keyboard and he focused on the computer screen, intently reading the output from her monitors.
The blue-white light highlighted his aquiline nose and reflected as tiny bright squares in his dark blue eyes. She drained the second glass of water he had brought her to help cool her body and swallow down the bitterness of her interaction with Brownrigg.
Just following protocol, Dr. Sullivan, he said with a smile.
Jimmy brushed his dark curly hair out of his eyes. Kira thought he had a pleasant face, and he could certainly turn on the charm. He worked mainly with biochips and tracking devices. He had tested one on her car, and she had teased him about being a stalker, or Q from James Bond. She'd never asked why he'd left his previous job as a GP. She didn't want to pry. She had spent 10 minutes in Cassandra's scanner, seething, after Brownrigg and Carter had left. Now she was standing next to Jimmy, looking at images of her own brain.
All looks good to me, he said, studying the screen. Your amygdala is lit up like a Christmas tree.
He faced her, curious now.
What was it like in his memory?
Stressful, she said, exhaling.
It's a shame I don't get some sort of heads up beforehand of what I might see.
Her hand reached up to her neck again.
It's not every day you get your throat cut.
It proved the tech worked. He seemed pretty impressed.
I wish I'd lied now and told him I couldn't see anything, she said, deflated.
I'm sorry. I know it's not what you wanted.
Bloody Carter. He only sees the money, she grunted.
Watch yourself, Jimmy said, turning back to the screen. You're on thin ice with him after the last row. You know what he's like. She ignored this and sat back down on the recliner.
Cosmo, look up Lieutenant General Brownrigg.
A montage of photographs and articles immediately filled the wall-mounted screens in front of her. Brownrigg as a young, handsome soldier, sandy hair, green eyes. Then older, with medals, bravery awards, leading his men out on the field. It all appeared so noble. Nothing to do with the death of a boy. She couldn't imagine the forces would want that highlighted, Even the hypernet didn't always get to the hidden truth. Your heart rate is coming down. It should be lower, though. It never goes up like this when you're in my head. Cosmo, lights 100%. She shielded her eyes against the brightness as the computer obeyed. Why did you call the lab computer, Cosmo?
Name of my first dog, he replied, looking at the screen. Loved that animal.
She nodded approvingly.
Reading memories was different with Jimmy. Cassandra had been her innovation. She had developed the nano and pico technology for it, but Jimmy had built most of the equipment using her blueprint. He had been one of the first people she had dared to test her work on, other than her lab assistant, Phil Brightman. Jimmy trusted her enough to let her rummage around in his brain. It was an intimate experience which she dealt with gently. She had gone looking for very specific details in his memory to test the machine. It was like a game of hide-and-seek. Jimmy would ask her something she couldn't possibly have known, and she had had to find the answer somewhere in his memory. She could still remember the first time, the most thrilling of all, when they knew the tech worked. They had spent most of the day playing games, Kira trying to discover tiny snippets of information from Jimmy. What set my asthma off in Spain when I was 13? She'd seen it clearly. A beautiful young Spanish girl, her long dark lashes over brown eyes, Jimmy trying to talk to her in broken Spanish. The girl had suddenly reached her arms around his neck and kissed him on the lips, and then ran away laughing. Jimmy had been so thrilled, or panicked, maybe even both, that it had triggered a mild asthma attack. Later, when they were laughing about it in the lab, Jimmy had said he'd been so embarrassed that he hadn't told a soul. He didn't laugh so much when Kira told him some weeks later that she had been experiencing a tightness of her chest occasionally, usually immediately after they'd used the technology. It was then that she had begun to wonder about the less obvious side effects of Cassandra. Was it really possible to pick up physical traits after being in someone else's memories? Going into Jimmy's memories was like going into a friend's house to collect an important item. She knew her way around and didn't feel uncomfortable poking about or peering behind the scenes, as long as she was quick and respectful. By contrast, travelling into Brownrigg's mind had felt like trespassing. She'd never met him before and hadn't known anything about him before she'd gone in. Who knew what she might have found inside his brain, what she might have picked up? Jimmy grabbed a small scanner and wheeled his chair over to the recliner and passed it over her face and neck. He's seen some awful things. It was literally like hell. Jimmy checked the reading. All looks good here. He faced the main screen and Kira stood up and stretched. What time is it? She asked.
The time is 18 hours, 4 minutes, came a disembodied electronic male voice.
Thank you, Cosmo. Cassandra, reset, please.
Kira commanded. There was a mechanical gliding sound as the bed moved back into position, then two beeps and a small red light on the main circular part of the machine turned green.
Are you sure you're okay? Jimmy asked. Tight chest again. Anything we should worry about?
No, she shook her head. I'm just annoyed.
God, if she could pick up asthma from Jimmy, what the hell might she have inherited from Brownrigg?
Psychosomatic at worst. She paused and then said tentatively, You don't think Phil Brightman's heart attack had anything to do with Cassandra, do you?
Helping Kira with testing the kit in the initial stages of development had been one of Phil's main duties. He had died in his sleep not long after a transference experiment. That had been when Jimmy had stepped in, taking time out of his own work in the lab next door to Kira's to see how the kit he had helped build worked.
No, Jimmy said, concentrating on the screen in front of him. I don't think people have psychosomatic heart attacks.
I suppose not.
Kira took off her white coat and hung it on the back of the door.
Undiagnosed heart condition. Could have seen him off at any time, Jimmy added.
Yes, of course. Nothing to do with Cassandra, she reassured herself. He turned away from the screen to look at her. Have you been having any more of those dreams? She wished she hadn't told him if he was going to keep on making a fuss about it. They had decided that the vivid dreams she sometimes had after transferences were residual memories, things that had somehow stuck in her brain. But they seemed bloody real in the middle of the night when she was in the dark, alone. No. The corners of her mouth dipped as she shook her head, but there was tension in her jaw, and she didn't meet his eyes. Well, here's my prescription, he said, scribbling on a piece of paper and handing it to her. She knitted her eyebrows, anxious for a moment. There was one word on the piece of paper. Coffee. On me, she said, relieved for the time being. Kira pushed open the heavy glass door to the lab and Jimmy followed, the rubber soles of his shoes making a slight squeaking sound on the grey matte tiles. The lights in the corridors were a series of spotlights from above, which caused pools of brightness intermittently along the dark floor, and at the base of the walls there were glowing strips of light beading, which gave a kind of backgammon board pattern. Carter had done a good job of designing this space. He was good at what he did, using money to make money. Quality attracts quality, he said often enough. Many of the walls in Carter Tech were glass. Kira could often see Jimmy working in his own lab next to hers. His tech was increasingly in demand. He inserted biochips under the skin for banking, handy if you left home without any money, and bio-tracking devices for children of paranoid parents, or errant husbands, as he sometimes joked. More recently, he had developed a tech that allowed him to implant nanomobile communication devices under the skin. Biophones, he nicknamed them, but Kira wasn't too sure she liked the idea of being ever available. The coffee machine was in the waiting area, or the foyer, as Carter liked to call it. He had placed large canvases of what Kira supposed he considered arty paintings around the room, images of various parts of the human body in gaudy colours in thick lines of paint. A blue hand, an orange back, a green face. There was a ceramic sculpture of the human brain on a pedestal on the reception desk, the phrenological areas marked out in black lines and glossy lettering. Kira hated that the most. She flashed her credit card towards the coffee machine for payment. Two black coffees? She wasn't ready for a banking chip under the skin, she had decided, even though Jimmy had offered her one. Jimmy sprawled onto one of the grey, angular sofas whilst the machine took its time to dispense the coffee. As soon as one cup was full, Kira picked it up and moved over to hand it to him. Carter burst in from the main door. She jumped, hot coffee spilling on her hand. Jimmy sat up straight. Thanks for nearly fucking that up! He stood in front of her, shoulder squared, face florid. I've shown Brownrigg out, but believe me, I have had to do some serious work in the last half hour to convince him to go through with this deal. Jimmy stood up, took his coffee from Kira, and quietly made his way back to his own lab. Human rights? What on earth were you thinking? Have you any idea how long it took me to set up this meeting? How important the Lieutenant General is? Kira turned her attention back to the coffee machine, her blood feeling like the churning hot water being spewed out from the nozzle onto the synthetic coffee granules. The Army, Carter. Don't you think I should have known that before I went into the war zone in his head? The things I saw in there... You could have bloody warned me. I said from the start when we made this partnership, you're the brains, I'm the business. He screwed up his eyes and then opened them. You have the ideas and I sell them. I let you do whatever you want in that lab and I pay for all of it, he growled. You have to let me do my job. You've got to trust me that I have the interests of the company at heart. I approached the MOD first because we have the tech, they have the money. It's a straight trade. She turned to face him. Yes, and look how they're going to use it. We're talking about
going into someone's memory without their consent, Carter. It's not a bloody police state. You can't go into someone's house without a search warrant. There's no way the government would sanction this. I wouldn't have left criminal profiling if I'd known my tech was going to be used for brain-hacking people against their will. It's a necessary evil to beat the terrorists. Think of the recent anti-poverty protests, the acid attacks, the arson, the water poisonings. They're not going to go away, Kira. The public is afraid. And where there's fear, there's money. Come on, think about what you could do for your family. Pay your mum's mortgage off, university fees for your niece. Leave Molly out of this, she hissed. How dare he use her niece to emotionally blackmail her? Brownrigg clearly seems to think this is cut and dried. In fact, he says, I can't use my own technology because it's got to be top secret. The hand holding the coffee was shaking. She put the cup down on the reception desk. Jesus, Kira, for a smart woman, you're being really stupid right now. He sighed heavily. Don't you get it? The MOD are terrified your tech is going to get into the wrong hands and... Wrong hands? She spat. Brownrigg says it's good if we have it on our side, catastrophic if it's on theirs. Our side? Snorted Kira. All of a sudden you're interested in politics and terrorism. He stepped in close to her and she leaned back a little. Yes, if they're going to offer the sort of money that Brownrigg suggested. We won't need to sell the tech to anyone else. We'll be flush. His eyes always lit up when he talked about money. Carter, how many times do we have to fight about this before you get the message? You knew all along why I designed this tech. You knew I wanted it to go to the justice system. Imagine the accurate witness statements, helping innocent people who have been wrongly convicted and assisting families who need closure. His facial expression changed momentarily, becoming softer. Was he going to be swayed? But then his eyes narrowed again. That's pie in the sky, Kira. You know there's no way that you could use this sort of tech-accessed witness statements in court, not for years yet. There's still work to be done before it gets to that stage. More empirical evidence to show it's 100% reliable, more testing needed. There's no way we'd get any money from the justice. Jesus, Carter, it's not all about money. Look, I know you're upset, he began. I'm not upset, I'm furious. She jabbed a finger towards him. With you. And yet here you are, ready to sell it to the highest bidder exclusively, she said, picking up her cup and turning back to face him. So not only will it go to brain-hacking interrogators, but I won't be able to use it for anyone else. Calm down. We're partners. You shouldn't have agreed to anything before speaking to me. You saw the money and thought, screw Kira's opinion. We both signed that agreement when we made this partnership. If you break the contract, then you might as well go. We don't have to work together, Kira. If you can find someone who will fund your work and let you invent what the hell you like, then fine. You can go and work with them. Is that a threat or a promise? If you go against me again, you'll find out. She focused on the sculpture of the brain. So crass. It's out of my hands, Kira. The MOD will take it from us anyway, even if we don't sell it to them. It's too powerful. Might as well make some money on it. Move on to a new project. What about the memory loss project you told me about? That sounds like a goer. She didn't answer, was too busy fighting back hot tears. She didn't want him to see her cry, so she turned back and picked up her cup, sipped at the coffee, and winced. She remembered when she was little and her dad used to make a pot of real coffee and the smell of it would waft around the house. Not like this man-made rubbish. I know you want to do what's right. Look on the bright side. He paused, dropped his hands to his waist. Selling to the MOD will do good. You can't argue against preventing terrorism. They've really upped their game lately.
You can't go shopping these days without someone setting off a device nearby because they're pissed off that someone else has more money than them, or some eco-warriors are kicking off. He sighed, clearly burned out. There are other people out there who would be grateful to work here. She faced him, unable to hide her fury.
What? You're going to take your ball home, Carter? You're going to sack me? She goaded.
Don't make this difficult for both of us. I picked you because you were the best. He scowled at her. But don't mess this up. You've got to focus on the future, your future.
I can't believe that I was so desperate to build the tech that I would work with anyone, even you.
She leaned over and through her teeth said,
If I'd have known what an asshole you were, I wouldn't have taken your money.
His ego wouldn't cope with that. She might as well have slapped his face. Some of her anger subsided into anxiety. Had she gone too far this time? She wasn't going to back down now.
You're totally out of order, Carter growled. I've warned you before that your behaviour was going to cost you your job if you went against me again. Against you? But we're partners, you arrogant...
But he ignored her.
You were the best we've ever had here. But your obsession and your pig-headedness mean that we can no longer sustain a working relationship.
His expression was aggrieved, betrayed.
If you could only have stuck to the rules, towed the line... But this,
he shook his head,
such a shame. Get your stuff. Get out.
Moments later, Kira stood outside the door, bag in hand, coat over her arm. What the hell had she just done? Chapter 3. Thursday, 1st of February, 2035. 6:56 p.m. Driving home through the rain-washed streets of London was like moving in a vivarium. The temperature rose slightly as the tall buildings trapped the warmth. The last time Kira had seen frost in the city had been before she lost Emma, 14 years ago. A cold February seemed to be a thing of the past. Even at this time of year, the damp and the warmth gave rise to mossy bricks and pavement crack weeds, life forcing its way out of every crevice, like sweat from pores. Eco-auto drives and push bikes moved up and down the street. There were fewer cars, as public transport had been heavily invested in and was made free to workers to reduce higher living costs, but also to minimise impact on the environment. Her electric car was a luxury she was prepared to pay for, and one that her work afforded her. Kira parked up and walked along the high street, the stink from the drains in the gutter giving way to the delicious aromas wafting from the open door of the deli. The sky was dark, but bright sales pops shone out of every shop window. Short, snappy 3D commercials projected out onto the street. Sometimes they included personalised targeted adverts, PTAs triggered by identity smart cards in bags and pockets. A pair of brown leather ankle boots, her favourite brand, presented themselves right in front of her, mid-air, and spun around slowly so that she could see them from all angles. This time yesterday she might have been tempted, but right now all she could think about was how angry she was with Carter. She'd have to wait until she got a new job before another shopping spree. Bloody Carter! Just when everything had seemed to be going her way... She had her life the way she wanted, didn't she? She could afford her own place, a nice car, decent wine, the little luxuries. Even Molly, her niece, seemed quite settled lately. Kira thought about the last time Molly had run off, after the argument about college. Now that she was nearly 18, she might start to act more maturely, find some balance. There were other screens stationed intermittently down the street. So cheap they were everywhere these days, on walls or standing upright from the pavement at the bus stops. They displayed mainly adverts or news pops, short news videos. The one currently showing was about the recent crime wave associated with the Chinese drug, Lie. Along with the influx of Chinese trade and brain power came the inevitable dark side too, the sex workers and the highly addictive Lie. Kira rummaged in her bag for her purse as she walked along, swerving stationary viewers who were staring at screens. It was one of life's little irritations when trying to get around town.
Did you enjoy your last holiday to France, Kira? Have you thought about travelling further afield? Leave all your problems behind for a little while, suggested one screen.
From the corner of her eye, Kira noticed a man moving in time with her down the street. She turned around to look. He was wearing an army uniform. When he saw her turn around, he stopped to look in a shop window. Outside the pharmacy, a scanner turned in her direction and a sales pop asked her if she was stressed and suggested she should try Vitamix Energy Boost. She swatted it away like an annoying insect and went into the convenience shop next door and bought two bottles of wine. It was only British Sauvignon Blanc, grown somewhere along the Thames estuary, but expensive enough. She might as well, whilst there was still money in her pocket, and it would take the sting out of Carter's betrayal, for tonight, anyhow. She put the bottles in her bag and went back out into the street. Tomorrow she would think about a new job. She would relax and take it easy tonight. God, what if she ended up in one of those awful genetic research labs? For a brief moment, she thought back to her time with the police. Yes, the pay had been amazing, and her work in the profiling department had been fascinating, but she didn't have the guts for it anymore. It had all been so uncertain. Guesswork. Educated, possibly. Informed, definitely, but guesswork nonetheless. She pushed the idea out of her mind and made her way back to the car, the two bottles chinking together softly in her bag. She checked her comms watch to see if there were any messages from her mum or Molly. Instead, there was one from Jimmy. You okay? She ignored it, unwilling to think about what had happened, and moved further down the street. She reached the car and, out of the corner of her eye, noticed the soldier again, hanging back a little, and her blood boiled. She pulled her comset out of her bag, deliberately using it and not her hidden earpiece. Dial Carter. The line connected, but switched straight to answer machine.
It's Kira. Look, you can tell your mate Brownrigg, she said loudly, that I'm no threat to national security, so he can call his spies off.
She turned to face the soldier, hoping to embarrass him, but he was gone. She looked up and down the street. He was nowhere to be seen. She threw her comset back into her bag, furious that Carter had put her in such a position. She reached the car and put her hand out for the handle, only to stop halfway as the nearby screen attracted her attention with a news pops.
Urgent! Have you seen this man?
Kira froze and caught her breath. Her guts immediately knotted into a small, tight ball. Her ribcage became a hive of bees buzzing in the space where her heart should have been. She recoiled from the image, stepping back into the path of a big woman who pushed her roughly aside and called her a vulgar name. Kira's mouth dried as she gaped at a face she hadn't seen for 14 years, a face she had prayed never to see again. The soulless, dark brown eyes set beneath heavy brows, the face puffy and angry, lips pressed together in a thin, cruel line.
Police have launched a nationwide manhunt for an escaped criminal, David Lomax. How could the newsreader sound so calm? Did she know what sort of man this was?
The people passing by were getting on with their everyday lives, no hint or suggestion of fear or distress.
Lomax, 58, nicknamed the Mitzpah murderer, was convicted of the death of 6 women 14 years ago. This afternoon, he managed to evade police when granted permission to attend his mother's funeral at City Necroplex. Despite an intensive effort, Lomax has not been apprehended. Police have warned the public not to approach him, but to contact them immediately if... This was the man convicted for the death of 6 women, one of whom had been her beautiful, funny, rebellious sister, Emma. Her heart ached, a grief she kept so well hidden suddenly rearing.
She had worked on Lomax's case, and it had almost destroyed her. She had been the psychologist who had built a profile and made suggestions to the police, but it hadn't been enough. She should have been able to find something definite that would have led the police to the killer before he took his next victim, before he had taken Emma. The image of the names and dates, scratched into the back of her notebook as the case progressed, came to her mind. Two women, each February, for 3 years in a row. 2019, unknown woman and Skylar Laundry. 2020, Madeline Cooper and Jennifer Bosanquet. 2021, Emma Sullivan and Amelia Brigham. It had been an unusual case, an unusual modus operandi. The first woman each year, described by the police as Type A, unknown, Madeline and Emma, had been mutilated and dumped in a horrible place. Then, within a week, another woman, Type B, Skylar, Jennifer and Amelia, had been abducted and killed, but left whole and posed in water. Each of the Type B victims wore a necklace, a mitzvah pendant, which had given rise to the killer's moniker in the press. After Emma's death, Kira had eventually pulled her life together again. When she had helped to get her mum and Molly through the worst, she had left her old life behind. Her job with the police, her apartment, her relationship, tried shedding her grief along with everything else, and gone to work in the Department of Neuropsychopathy at the university. It had kept her busy, given her a focus other than sorrow and regret. Her work in the safe place behind the white walls of her lab became almost a mission, trying to locate the problem in the criminal brain, and in some cases even, to some degree, fix it. It had been whilst she was trying to work in this particular area that she had designed Cassandra. Then Carter had made her an offer, and she had moved to Cartertech. An image of Lomax's first victim came up on the screen, a woman, but only a pencil sketch. There had been no identity, and therefore no family to provide a photograph of her alive. Kira remembered the empty chapel at the Necroplex. The grey pencil lines made the woman look transparent, a ghost, as though she had hardly ever existed in real life. The next photograph showed Madeline Cooper in her school uniform, 15 years old, thin, mousy hair, watery blue eyes, and a reluctant smile. Kira had advised Tom, the detective in charge of the case, to show this image as opposed to any other. Probably the last one of Madeline before her hectic lifestyle took over. The public would be more inclined to help if they could see the person behind the dishevelled mess that she had become in the last 2 years of her life. Kira moved rapidly to another screen at a nearby bus stop, not wanting to be in the presence of others when the inevitable appeared. And then, there she was. Emma, never to age, long, dark, shiny hair, in a crimson dress, taken from a social media posting of a night out, the arms of friends still visible around her shoulders on the periphery of the image. Kira cried out in the street, unable to repress the swell of anguish as she was immediately taken back to the moment that they had found Emma's body, Tom restraining her as she screamed and wrestled against him to get to her sister's body. She had resented him for it at the time, even though she later understood why. And suddenly, she was back in the nightmare. She ran back to the car, the image of her sister still on the screen, looking after her with judgment. If only her last words to Emma had been kinder. She placed her hand on the palm reader lock. The door clicked open and she threw herself in, shut the door and put her forehead onto the steering wheel, her hands gripping the rubber, feeling as though the world outside was spinning. Her first instinct was to ring Tom. He would know what was going on. He would reassure her, wouldn't he, that they were going to catch Lomax, that he wouldn't be waiting somewhere in the shadows to do to another woman what he had done to Emma. She immediately hated herself for looking to him. Tom had been so much more to her than just the senior investigating officer. That had been another thing that the mitzvah murderer had taken from her. But as the sweat cooled on her brow, She remembered the relief that she had felt, cutting ties with the police all those years ago and cutting ties with Tom. What choice had she had but to walk away? She had needed to draw a line under that time of her life, and sadly, that had meant Tom too. How could they have stayed together, enjoyed any happiness at all, in the face of all that grief, that guilt? Lomax was out. A rising bile burned her throat. She opened the car door and vomited into the gutter. An elderly couple walking past moved away in disgust. Kira spat the bitterness from her mouth and sat back up in the driver's seat, pulling the door shut. "Door's locked," she said, not feeling the usual satisfaction at the click when the car complied. "Search Hypernet. Contact number Tom Morgan, detective," she commanded, and seconds later a number appeared on her comset watch. She took a deep breath. This was opening up old wounds, but she needed to know. "Dial." A brief beep and then, "Tom Morgan?" She cleared her throat and steeled herself. "It's Kira." A pause on the other end. "Kira, hi. I wondered if I might hear from you. Are you all right?" She was tongue-tied for a moment, not sure how to start. "Look, I should have called you," Tom began, filling the awkward silence. "I was hoping to have better news by the time I called."
"You mean he's still out?"
"Yes, I'm afraid so." The hive in her chest started buzzing again, the bees travelling through her bloodstream into her limbs, making them feel weak.
"Tom, he killed Emma," she said. Her voice sounded small and far away.
As if he didn't know. As if he hadn't been the one holding her back so she didn't have to see the destruction. "We're going to find him, Kira." The words brought back bitter memories. So much had changed in the last 14 years, but hearing Tom's voice somehow brought the two points of time together.